All right, let's start. So last time we left off, we were talking about representation, how you represent different types of data. And we had a few examples, right? We talked about how you can represent images with just pixels. So this works for digits. We talked about what you can do with slightly more complicated images where pixels won't work. We talked about how you can represent text in terms of attribute value pairs. And we also discussed why the most straightforward representation, where you have one variable, the first attribute for the first word, the second attribute for the second word, why this is not a good idea, right? Because a small change in the email will lead to a drastic change in the representation. And we talked about how a much better way to represent text is to have one attribute per vocabulary word, a numeric attribute, and then the value of that attribute tells you if the word is present or absent in a particular email or in a particular piece of text, right? So this is sort of you're using a set to represent a piece of text or a vector of binary variables. Okay. Most of today's lecture is on the basic probabilistic issues that you'll need for the remainder of the course. But before we do that, I'll briefly talk about some of the issues that come up in machine learning. So we already talked about supervised or unsupervised, and hopefully I gave you some idea of what the difference is between the supervised and unsupervised methods, right? So really the big difference is in the supervised case, you are trying to predict something specific, like an age or a gender, or whether you should lend money to somebody. In an unsupervised case, you're trying to learn something about the data set. If you're dealing with a supervised case, what you're predicting is actually quite important, and you often have to think about that before diving into building a learning algorithm. I'll also briefly talk about outliers and how how to detect different types of outliers and missing data. What we're predicting, if you are the simplest case is you're trying to do classification. So you have a collection of instances and you want to classify them into one or more groups. So ham or spam, for example, or is this individual male or female based on whatever representation you came up with. So the important issues to look at when you're doing classification are what the classes look like. What is it that you're trying to predict? Do you just have two classes, right? So if you have two, you have perhaps ham and spam. That makes things easy. But if you have multiple classes, things become a little bit more tricky. So for example, are the classes mutually exclusive? Can you ever have an individual that's both in class A and in class C, for example? And if you do, that will impact the type of the classifier that you can build. For us, most of the time we will assume that classes are exclusive. So if an individual is A, he cannot possibly be C. We will also assume that, if the classes are not exclusive, then you should ask yourself, do I need to model dependence between the classes? So for example, if an individual is allowed to be a member of A and also allowed to be a member of C, should I be predicting A and C independently of each other, or do you expect them to correlate? If you expect them to correlate, it actually makes more sense to try to predict it at once. A really big issue with classification is dominating classes. So for example, if you are trying to build a classifier that will look at an academic paper that's just been written and predict whether that paper will lead up to a Nobel Prize, right? So suppose you want to do something like that. For this particular task, you can actually build a classifier that's 99.99% accurate. And it's really easy. All you have to do is you just have to build a classifier that always says no. No, this is not going to lead to a Nobel Prize. And probably 999 times out of 1,000, you are going to be right, because very few papers make it to the Nobel Prize. So this is an instance where the positive and the negative class are very imbalanced. There is lots of negatives out there, and if you just say no, 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 you're going to correctly classify all of those negatives. And the fact that you never get any positive, okay, so what? You're still 99.9% accurate, right? So this is something that you want to be aware of when you're building a classifier. Are the classes balanced? And if they're not balanced, you will probably need to redesign your error metric. Okay, another issue. So up until now, we've been talking about representing data, and we said that we're going to represent data as attribute-value pairs. Now, an attribute with a value, it's kind of like a brick, and those bricks get put together in a vector representation, but there's no structure among the bricks. So if you reordered all of the, if you reordered all of the columns in the vector, if you reordered all of the attributes, the representation should still remain the same. That works for lots of data. So for example, it works with text, the kind of representation that we came up with, but sometimes you need to deal with data where there is a structure embedded and where it's the structure that is important. So how do you deal with that? And what you need to do is you need to take the structured data set and somehow map it to a form where there is no structure, where all the structure is embedded in the attributes themselves, right? So here's one example. A tree is a very common type of structure that pops up in the data. So if you have a tree like that, how could you possibly represent it as attribute value pairs? When one way, and this is just one possibility, is to enumerate the tree, sort of look at all the paths that go from the root to the leaf, right? So in this tree, you have ABA as a path and ABB as a possible path. So you would say that attribute ABA as a possible path through that tree is present, ABB is present, but say ABC is not present because this tree does not have a path that goes from A to B to C, right? So this is one way to flatten the tree. You're still keeping the structure, you're still keeping the paths, but you're turning it into a flat vector. This is something that you can put into any of your learning algorithms, and they will work fine on that, right? Otherwise, it's pretty difficult to get a classifier to work on that. Usually you would have to build something custom made for this particular domain. Okay, so that's structure in the input data. Sometimes, and this is, we're not going to talk about that at all, but sometimes you also have structure in the output, right? So not only does your input look perhaps like a tree, but what you're trying to predict is not a category and not a number, but perhaps has some sort of a structure embedded into this, right? So we're not going to be covering any of these tasks in IAML. They're generally dealt with in separate disciplines, but if you absolutely must, there is a very simple, mathematically simple, computationally not simple, way of turning this into a standard classification problem, right? And what you could do is you could take the output and embed it in the input, right? And then instead of trying to learn a function that maps structures to other types of structures, what you do is you have a function that gets two structures and answers yes or no. Does it map or does it not map, right? So I'm playing a trick here. I'm saying, I know how to do classification. I know how to build a yes-no classifier. I don't know how to build a classifier that predicts structures. So I'm reducing the structure prediction problem to a yes-no problem. Right? And to do that, what you have to do is you have to embed the output into the input. And does anybody see any problem with this? Yeah? Yes, it increases the size of the input potentially infinitely, because there could be an infinite number of possible things that you could predict. So this, for example, happens when people build machine translation engines, when they try to statistically translate from one language to another. The space of things here is potentially infinite. So really, you're shifting the complexity from classification into search. You have to efficiently search over these structures. And if you can do that, then this actually works out quite nicely. Okay, so that's a trick. All right, the last thing that I want to talk about is outliers in the data. So this is something that impacts classifiers a whole lot. Most of the data that we'll be dealing with has numeric attributes, where attributes have numbers as possible values. And what you will have is you will always have instances where some value of some attribute is just off the chart, right? It's either really, really huge, or perhaps it's negative, and they're all supposed to be positive, like negative height. What does an individual with a height of minus 2 meters mean? Right? What do you do with them? So so outliers, you have to do something with them. And there is basically two types. The easier type of an outlier is shown right here. So this is an outlier where you could look at one dimension, one attribute, and figure out that this point has a value that's really bizarre, right? So for example, if I just look at x, all the points in my data have x around this value, and this point has x that's way off, right? So that's something that you can use to threshold pretty reasonably. So I could perhaps compute the standard deviation of the data and then look for points that are a certain number of standard deviations away from the mean. So outliers aren't always so nice. This, for example, is an outlier as well, but you're not going to be able to detect it by looking at an unusually large or small x or unusually large or small y, right? The x for this point is, it's kind of usual. It's not off the charts. The y value is not off the charts either. But together, they make a point that's pretty far away from the rest of the data. So that's another type of the outlier. They're much more difficult to detect. Usually you end up having to measure distances or do something else. A big thing here, when you're dealing with outliers, it always helps to try and visualize the data. So if you can find a way to plot your data, you can usually spot outliers very easily. Now, data is multidimensional. You're not going to be able to plot it all the time, but you should try to do that whenever you can. Right. So another issue that happens with classifiers is missing data. So that's usually when you're dealing with structured data in a database. So some guy could perhaps have, you know, they forgot to ask him about his employment history. So you just don't have any value for his employment history. How do you deal with that in the classifier? Some classifiers deal with missing data a lot easier than others. For others, you have to come up with something. So, for example, a lot of the regression linear classifiers that are coming up in a few lectures, they require a number always. So, if you have an attribute, you must have a number, and what that means is you have to come up with some sort of a number to put in there, and effectively making up data in order to classify this one individual. Okay, there's lots of other issues that you consider. I won't actually go into them. One issue that I did want to mention is the computational complexity. So this is something that we're not going to be talking about in this course, but in practice, this is quite important. So if you're dealing with a large amount of data, you will have choices, and different classifiers will be fast or slow, will require 20 gigs of memory or less than that, and that's something that you have to consider in practice. One big thing that I want to stress is there is a difference between complexity at the training time and at the testing time. Most of the time, the training complexity is something that you can afford, but you want the classifier to be really fast at the testing phase. So, for example, linear classifiers that you'll see in a few lectures, they're relatively slow at training time, but they're very fast when you have to predict things for new instances. Something like k-nearest neighbors has zero training cost, but is very expensive at testing time. So that's something that you want to keep in mind. All right, I think I'm done.
Yeah, it's fine.
because I didn't plug it in. That's why you can't see it. Okay, so in the rest of the lecture, I'm going to talk about probability. So you've probably seen this in some of your previous courses, either last year or maybe before you came to Edinburgh. And I just want to highlight so I'll try to go reasonably quickly, but I'll try to highlight the aspects of probability that we'll use in the remainder of the course. So the first question is, what is probability good for? So probability is essentially a calculus for managing uncertainty. So when I think about it, it was classically developed in order to talk about gambling. So people wanted to know the odds of certain kinds of bets involving cards or dice or roulette wheels, things like that. But we can actually apply it much more generally, and in fact we will apply it much more generally in this course. So for example, one subject which I'm currently very uncertain about is whether my first child, which has not occurred yet and is not foreseen anytime soon, will be a boy or a girl. Or we could say something more on an aggregate level. If I want to know how many children were born in the UK next year. Right, so that's something, it's a number, as opposed to being a yes or no boy or girl choice. Or I could also want to have probabilities over extremely large spaces. So for example, something that's uncertain for you, not for me, is what the title's going to be on the next slide. And you might want to have probability distributions over that, over all possible titles. So there are two things that that kind of come up when you think about probability in the context of artificial intelligence or machine learning that maybe you don't think about when you're thinking about probability as a more abstract subject. And the first one is that uncertainty depends on what you know already. So the title of the next slide is not uncertain for me because I looked at it before I came up. Otherwise, I would have forgotten. And the other thing is that uncertainty is a pragmatic decision. So you may, sometimes you may have a really complicated phenomenon like flipping a coin. So if I'm flipping a coin, if I actually know when the coin leaves my finger, exactly what the angular momentum and velocity of it are, and whether it's heads or tails, then the outcome isn't uncertain anymore. It's just governed by the laws of physics. So what makes a coin flip uncertain is the fact that it's so sensitive to the initial conditions that you might as well treat it as random. So those are two things. So that's kind of why we, that's why we care about probability, but why do we care about probability in machine learning? You're waiting for that. So what makes machine learning algorithms uncertain is that I don't know what the training data will be. So if I'm training some kind of classifier on images, I'm sampling the training data from the set of all possible images that have tigers and zebras and hippopotamuses in them. And so that creates a source of noise. So if I want to analyze a machine learning algorithm, I might want to kind of be able to talk about the uncertainty that's due to the choice of training set. Also, the training data itself might have noise in it. So if I'm doing classification, say, from robot sensors, the laser rangefinders or the sensors that are in the robot are themselves going to have some kind of measurement noise. And I might want to try to estimate that measurement noise as part of some kind of machine learning algorithm. So many of the algorithms that we see in this course are actually going to use probabilities explicitly. You'll be able to open up the algorithm and there's going to be some number that you can point to that says, this is the sensor noise that I think exists at this point in the algorithm. So some machine learning algorithms, you can do that. Some machine learning algorithms, you can't. Right, it's just some kind of computer program that you can look at. It makes some decision. You might be able to make some kind of probability distribution over that decision. But actually, if you look within the code, there's nothing that looks like a probability within it. Even so, you might be able to analyze that kind of algorithm using a probabilistic analysis. So it's still kind of useful to know about probabilities within machine learning. Okay, so the fundamental thing that we talk about in probability is called a random variable. This is something you've probably seen before. So intuitively, you can think of a random variable as being like a mathematical variable whose assignment is uncertain, that you'll have a distribution over. Now, if you wanted to set this up formally, like we would do in a probability class, then we talk about something called a sample space.
and every event would be a subset of that space, and a random variable would actually be a map from the sample space to the set of states of the variable. But we're not going to need that level of formality in the course. So if you think of a random variable X has something that can be assigned to one of a number of outcomes that has some distribution, that's probably enough to be going on with. So for example, the color of the next car you'll see on the street, that has some kind of discrete set of states. It's uncertain because you haven't seen it yet. So that would include some states kind of blue, green, red, you know, mauve. I don't know what other colors cars can be. Any function of a random variable is also a random variable. So if I were to flip a coin, whether that coin is heads or tails is a random variable. But I could also flip a coin twice and then square the number of heads I can get. That's also a random variable. Now, there are two kinds of random variables that we're going to consider in this course, discrete random variables and continuous random variables. And that has to do with just what the outcome space of the random variable is. A discrete random variable is one in which the outcome is either drawn from a finite set or from a countable set, so like the set of all natural numbers. So throughout this course, we're going to use the notation that's up here, which when we want to talk about the probability of a random variable taking some value, we can use the random variable itself, take some uppercase letter, and the set of an outcome x will take a lowercase letter. And then we'll typically shorten it to be something like that, because otherwise this notation would get very unwieldy. So what this function is, it's called a probability mass function. What it does is it takes, so if I take, consider some random variable here, which you could think of it as, so this is a discrete random variable. It takes outcomes. You can't really see the x-axis here, but I'll just tell you what it says. This is 0, and this is 35. So this random variable can take numbers from 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 35. What this thing here is the probability of that number. So this is a plot of this probability mass function. So what this probability mass function does is it takes some possible outcome of the random variable and it maps it to a probability. So what we require of these things, we require two things of these probability mass functions. First, they always be positive, because a negative probability makes no sense. And second, that if we sum them over the entire space, so in this case, the sum over all possible values of x, in this case would be from 0 to 35, of the probability of that value equals 1. Some examples of discrete distributions would be things like a coin toss. Things like if we went through this entire class and took the number of letters in your surname, there'd be another random variable. Maybe it has this distribution here. Or if I want to deal with text, those typically involve discrete random variables. So the third word on this slide is another example of a discrete random variable. Typically we've seen this before. This is an example of a probability mass function. A simple way to estimate the distribution of a discrete random variable would be just to count. So if I wanted to estimate what's the distribution over surname lengths in the entire School of Informatics, I could take this lot here as a sample, and I could go through all of you and count how many times I get a last name with 10 letters, 11 letters, and so on, and I'd get some histogram like this one. That's what this kind of diagram is called. So I'd have the x-axis is the number of characters in your last name, and the y-axis is the frequency, so the number of people who had that surname length. And I'd get some kind of plot like that, and if I normalized it so that these are now numbers between 0 and 1, rather than counts, I get an estimate of a probability mass function. So that is to do with distributions over discrete random variables, but we'll also be interested in distributions over multiple random variables. In fact, those will prove very important in this course. The reason for that is that oftentimes we'll have some random variables will involve the output of a classifier, and some random variables will involve the features. So one example here is if I'm doing, say I'm trying to do spam classification. So this would be some distribution over how often, so y will refer to whether an email is ham or spam. And X might refer to, did I say on the slide? No. So, oh yeah, I did. So X might refer to whether the word password is, whether the word password is present or not. So those are two random variables. I might want to talk about how likely all four combinations of those things are. The way to do that is called a joint distribution. So we'll write a joint distribution using this notation. So this will say the probability of seeing the word password in an email that is also ham is given by some number. So this is going to map between between joint configurations or between vectors of a set of random variables and then maps it to a number between 0 and 1. So a way to think about a joint distribution is using a contingency table. So a contingency table just enumerates all possible values of the x variable and the y variable and gives me a probability for both of these. So if I sum all four of these things, then it has to be, these have to add up to 1 in order for this contingency table to represent a joint probability distribution. So one thing, so if I say I start with a distribution over 2 variables and I want to get it down to a distribution over 1 variable, the way to do that is using a marginal probability. The name comes from the fact that the probability is a margin of this table. So what you would do is, whoops, if you want the marginal distribution, say, of how likely this feature is to be on or off, what I do is you sum over all possibilities of the other variables. So this thing is now a joint probability of seeing x in this state and y in this state, and I sum out all the values of y. So for example, if I believed that this distribution were correct, and I just wanted to know how likely am I to see ham emails versus spam emails, well, the probability of seeing a ham email altogether is the probability of seeing ham with the word password plus the probability of seeing ham without the word password. One or the other has to happen, and they're mutually exclusive. So I'll sum these two values, and I'll get 0.5 as being, if this distribution is correct, the probability of seeing a ham email. Okay, so what joint probabilities give you a way to do is to talk about whether both of two events happen. What a conditional probability does is it gives you a way to talk about one event given some other event. So the way we read this is to say what's the probability of the value x taking some value x given that I know that y takes some value y. So this is saying if I knew that for certain that y was true, then what's the distribution over x? So to go back to the slide example, one example would be if I knew the titles of all the slides, I might have a distribution. If I knew the title of this slide, I might have a distribution over what the first word of the slide is. And the definition of this thing is you do division. So you divide the joint probability of both of these things happening over the joint probability of y. So if you think about it intuitively, it's this conditional probability of x given y is how often do they both occur, divided by the number of times that y occurs, if you were to think of these in terms of frequencies rather than probabilities. So if I, a fundamental rule of probabilities is what's called the product rule or the chain rule of probabilities. And what this says is I can break up a joint probability into a conditional probability. So if I say take the probability of x times the probability of y given x, then I get the joint probability of y and x. So if I think, a kind of a good intuitive way to think about any kind of probability statement, and indeed any kind of probability brain teaser, is to think in terms of frequency. So if I think of, well, how many times do I see both x and y occur? It'll be the number of times that x occurs times the proportion of times where that x occurs that y also occurs. And you can do this in both directions. So for example, if you wanted to take this example, the example we had before, and say, well, what's the probability that I see the word password in any ham email? So that probability actually isn't listed in this table. These are all conjunctions. These are all joint probabilities. So if I wanted to actually calculate the conditional probability, I'd have to use this rule here. And what I would get would be 0.1 over 0.5. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So the other thing that's fundamental about conditional probabilities is Bayes' rule. So what Bayes' rule lets you do is it tells you how to reverse conditional probabilities. So it tells you, if I know, it basically helps you reason backwards. So if I know what the probability of y of x given y is, it helps me go backwards and figure out the probability of y given x. And the way you do that is you take the probability of x given y, the thing I know, and you divide it by the and you multiply times the probability of y over the probability of x.
It's actually very, very easy to prove this.
You just take this thing here, and you divide both sides by the probability of x.
That's it.
So it turns out, if you don't know the probability of x, you don't have to, as long as you can compute this thing on the top. Because you could always compute the probability of x by here, by summing over all the things y. And that's just this thing I had in the numerator. So what you can think of this as saying is the probability of y given x is this thing on top times some constant that doesn't depend on y. That's another way to think about Bayes' rule.
The reason why Bayes' rule is actually very important in machine learning is that, if
you think of y as being a class label, what this tells you how to do is say x is going to be some kind of feature. What this tells you how to do is if I know the relationship between class labels and features, this will let me go backwards and say if I only know the feature, what's my distribution over class labels?
And we'll see an example of doing that next week,
which is a very well-known classifier called the naive Bayes classifier.
So it's basically Bayes' rule plus another assumption, which makes it naive. You'll find out what that assumption is next week.
Okay, so once you know about conditional probability, you can also know about independence. So what independence means is that one variable doesn't affect another. So the simplest way to think about it is that the probability of y given x is the probability of y. That's true if y and x are independent. So formally, we can define this in terms of factorization, that the joint probability equals the product of the conditional probabilities, of the marginal probabilities. So it turns out, given this, you can prove this. It's a one-line proof. So that's independence among the marginals, but there's both. You can be marginally independent or you can be conditionally independent, and those are two different things. Conditional independence, an easy way to think about it is, so if I have two variables, x1 and x2, they're conditionally independent given y. If I also know x2, that doesn't change my probability over x. So the probability of x1 given both x2 and y is the same as the probability of x1 and y. So one interesting thing that I had had trouble thinking about at first was why these two are different. So if I have two variables that are marginally independent, they need not be conditionally independent, and vice versa. So one example of this, we'll see how good I am at this. So one example of this is consider the following three random variables. The first one, I won't pick on people. I could pick on people in the class, but I'm not going to do this. So the first one is, let's take two arbitrary people in the class. So I'm going to call them, I guess I need A and, what is it? It's A, what are the ones? A and B. So I'll say Bob and Alice. So B is going to be a random variable, yes or no, and it is Bob shows up at lecture. And A is going to be some random variable that says Alice shows up. And then L is going to be one more random variable, which is whether I show up. Now, if I show up, then if Alice and Bob don't know each other, it's probably independent whether they show up. So it could be that the probability that A and B are conditionally independent given that L is true. So if I show up, it's independent whether they show up. If I don't show up, then neither of them are going to show up. But these two aren't marginally independent, because if I don't show up, then neither Alice nor Bob are going to show up. Compressed explanation, but if you actually make up a probability table in this case, you can get an example and show that the we showed that the bottom statement holds if the top statement, where the top statement does not. Okay.
Okay, so that is, so we talked about continuous random variables, talked about discrete random variables, but you can do the exact same thing if the random variable is continuous. So the difference is the difference is instead of having a probability mass function, which takes this discrete outcome and maps it to a number between 0 and 1, you can have a density function. And so what a density function does is it tells you the probability of a region in the space. So one way you think of a density function is one way that you could define a density function is to say that the density function so if p of x is a density function for this probability statement here, what that means is if I want to know whether x, the random variable, actually falls in some interval, what I do is I integrate p of x. So what I've done is I've taken the sum. If this were a discrete random variable, I would take a sum. I would say I could sum all the numbers between a and b of the discrete mass function. So what I'm going to do instead in the continuous case is I'm going to take an integral. And a consequence of this is that the probability of x being any particular value is modeled to 0, because I'll just get the integral between a and a, and I'll get something that's 0. The two things that, so one way to think about a continuous random variable is it's just the limit of a discrete random variable. So if I took some, continuous random variable here. So this would be, I think this example would be if I go to the shop and if I go to Sainsbury's and they sell a number of haggises, and I can measure their length in centimeters. That's gonna give me a real number. If I say I use some kind of really accurate measure, I might model that as a real number. So I might have some small haggises and some large haggises, and so each one of those is going to kind of cluster somewhere around here on the x-axis. So I could take these real numbers that I've gotten and I could bin them. So I could say, well, there's, you know, one haggis between 10 and 15 centimeters, three of them between 15 and 20, and so on. And what I could do that way is I define a discrete random variable. And I could that discrete random variable has a probability mass function. So I could do that. And then I could look at, well, what happens is the bin size gets infinitely small. And if you do that, you get a continuous random variable. So if you've seen in a probability class the kind of standard construction where I start with a distribution function and then I take the derivative, the way you can think of that is it's a way of letting the bin size of a histogram go to 0. Now there are two ways to there are two requirements for a probability mass function. The first one is it always has to be positive, because if it weren't, I could have negative probabilities, which make no sense. And the second thing is, if I take the integral over the entire space, so for this case, it might be 0 to infinity of haggis length, then I have to get 1, because probabilities have to be bounded. You notice one thing that isn't required is that the probability function is less than 1. It doesn't matter. I could have a small area that has very high density, as long as when I integrate over the entire space, I get 1. Now, all of the things that we've talked about before, like Bayes' rule, conditional independence, joint densities, all of that, the same equations hold in the in the continuous case as in the discrete case. The difference is that I replace this p of a mass function with a density function. All of these things have means and variances. The mean is just the mean of a distribution is its balancing point. So if I imagine this continuous thing here, imagine I reached up and I put my finger under that graph. The place where I put my finger where it balances is the mean. And the way you compute that is you take an integral over the entire space of x weighted by p of x. So this is something that's called the expected value. It's also written as the expected value of x. So I can take the expected value of any function by taking the integral over all values of the function of the probability of that value times whatever this function is.
So the expected value of x is the mean, just the average value, weighted average. The variance is a measure of how spread out the distribution is. And basically, it's the expected value of the square distance from the mean. So what this is again, a weighted average of x minus the mean of x squared, where I'm weighted by the probability value of that value.
And that's also written as v of x for the variance. So an example of this is the uniform distribution. The uniform distribution is a continuous random variable such that all points are equally likely. And the density is very simple. So a parameter of the distribution is what the largest value is, n. So I'll have a uniform distribution over 0 to n. And the density function is just 1 over n. And if you think about that, you'll see, well, an example, a consequence of this is the probability of some x falling within any interval is just the length of the interval. It's just proportional to the length of the interval. So that the probability of x falling between 0 and 1 is the same as the probability of x falling between 4 and 5. And you can see that just because you get the integral over 0, 1 of 1 over n versus the integral over 4, 5 of 1 over n. And so if you go off and either know or look at the distribution if you use the equations on the previous slide, you can talk about the mean and the variance of a uniform distribution. The mean is, as you would expect, it's going to be halfway. And you can actually verify that using the definition on the previous slide. So this is an example where densities can actually be greater than 1. So if you take this and say, take the uniform distribution, say, between 0 and a half, then you'd get something where the density is 2, but I'm only integrating it between 0 and a half, so it still integrates to 1. So another example, I'm not going to go through. So you can also have joint distributions. You can have joint uniform distributions. So one example of this would be if imagine that I'm throwing darts on the dartboard. So there are two things you need to know about me. The first one is I'm extremely bad at darts. So any place on the dartboard is equally likely. And the second one is somehow it always actually lands in that outer circle. So given those two assumptions, you can talk about, well, what's the probability that the dart lands in the inner portion? And you can also have a joint density function for x and y. So assuming that the dart always lands in the outer circle, what would be the joint density?
Pi r.
So this circle, this outer circle here has a radius of 1. And I'm saying the dart is equally likely to land anywhere within the outer circle. Yeah. 1 over pi. So the area of this circle is pi r squared. Yeah, so it's one on pi.
And that's the joint density.
So that's a function of both x and y, but it just doesn't depend on either one because it's uniform. Okay, so another distribution that's actually going to come up again and again in the class is the Gaussian distribution.
The Gaussian distribution is just a very convenient distribution for kind of unimodal continuous quantities that cluster around some point. So this looks very, if you haven't thought about this, it looks very scary, but it's not. The way to think about a Gaussian distribution is it's e to the minus x squared. Everything else is just decoration. So this thing is just a constant that makes the whole thing integrate to 1. This thing just lets you change the location, lets you change where the Gaussian is centered. It's a parameter of the distribution mu. This thing lets you change how wide it is. It's another parameter of the distribution. But really what this is e to the minus x squared. So it turns out that if you actually do the integral, there's a trick that you need to know in order to actually compute the integrals that give you the mean and the variance. It's actually a cool trick, but I'm not going to go through it. If you know that trick, you can show that the mean of this distribution is actually mu, and the variance is sigma squared. So there's a particular, if I choose 0 and 1 here, then I get what's called a standard Gaussian or standard normal. So all Gaussians kind of look like this at some scale, at some location. And what scale that is depends on these two parameters. So if I choose, if I make sigma squared be very large, then I get a large variance. And so I'll have a wide Gaussian that looks like this. And if sigma squared is very small, I'll get some very tight Gaussian. It'll have low variance. You can also, that's a univariate Gaussian. You can also have multivariate Gaussians. This is, again, the equation for the general case is a little bit more complicated, but it actually has the same structure as the one that we just saw. So if I have two independent Gaussian variables, then it's really easy. Because then what I can do is if two variables were independent, I can just multiply their densities and I get their joint density. So this is what you get when you just multiply two Gaussian densities. Here's the one for sigma 1, for x1, here's the one for x2, and I just brought them together under the x to get this. Well, that's fine if they're independent, but that's not very interesting. What I like is to have Gaussian variables that are dependent on each other. So it turns out that if I take, in order to motivate how you do that, let's start by taking this thing up here, and I'm going to try to write it in a different form. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write it in a vector form. I'm going to take this vector x, and I'll make that the vector of, it's going to be a vector in R2 of x1 and x2, similarly for the mean. And now I'll take the sigma, it's going to be a matrix. It's going to be a diagonal matrix where I took the standard deviation from the first one and the standard deviation from the second one. And now it turns out that this equation here is exactly the same as this one, but in a different notation. So if you substitute this in here and do this matrix multiplication, it's just another way of writing this. This is a quadratic form, if you remember from linear algebra. Because these two are zeros, you don't get any cross terms. So you get something that looks like this. So now it turns out this thing is actually how you do any bivariate Gaussian. Did it say that on the previous slide? Yes. So what you substitute here, so again, it's just as before, I'll take this mu here is going to be the mean of the bivariate Gaussian. If these Gaussians aren't independent, then instead of having a zero here, I'll put some positive number there. That positive number is called the covariance. So the covariance if this thing is a matrix, sigma ij, which is a single element of that matrix, is going to be the covariance. The covariance is kind of a generalization of the variance for multiple, and what it is, it's when the variance was the expected value of xi minus mu I squared. The covariance of two variables xi and xj is going to be the expectation of the product, xi minus mu I times xj minus mu j. So if I substituted I for j in here, see, I get the variance. So what this does is it kind of determines how elliptical this distribution is. So let me go back here to explain this. This is a plot of the density function of a bivariate Gaussian. So this is variable 1, this is variable 2. The height is the probability density function. So you see, just like the regular Gaussian looks like a bell curve, a bivariate Gaussian looks like a bell hump. And if I were to take some kind of slice horizontally of this thing, I get some ellipse that looks like this. And how ellipsy that ellipse is, the eccentricity of that ellipse is defined by the covariance matrix. If I have if I put a zero here and make these things independent, then I'll get a circle here. And as I change this to make it bigger and bigger, so this is for the independent case. What happens for the independent? For the independent case, what I get is I'm going to get something that looks like that isn't tilted at all, and the length here and the length here depend on the standard deviation. So if I make this standard deviation small, that'll make this more squat. Now, if I add an off-diagonal number, if I change sigma I2, then I'll get an ellipse that looks like this when I take a cross-section of the density. So I'll get something that looks tilted. So what that means is you can see these variables are correlated. If this variable gets larger, then this variable tends to get larger as well. So these aren't independent variables. So an example of this would be if I look at the plot of weight versus height for a population. Those tend to be normally distributed if you actually go and count them in the real world, and they also tend to be correlated. If you get taller, you also tend to get heavier. So that would be a classic example for a bivariate Gaussian. So you can generalize. So that's I think I'll stop there for today. So there are two, so we'll have like 5 minutes, this will be like 5 or 10 minutes of next time. There are two announcements. So the first, we didn't talk about the tutorials or anything at the beginning, did you? No. Okay, so the first one is just, if you didn't get the email to clarify about the lecture times, is on Mondays we will be here at 2 p.m. On Thursdays we will be in Lecture Theater 3 at 2 p.m. And that's the way it's going to be. So that's, and the second thing is, we are going to start tutorials next week, and we're still organizing that, and we'll give you an announcement on Thursday. Okay, that's it. See you then. Yeah, I guess I do. 10 slides. Probably need to go through them a bit faster.
No, don't worry. It's it actually dovetails really nicely because I'm going to be talking about Naive Bayes.
Yeah.
And they will really appreciate the Bernoulli.
Yeah.
The Gaussian is very useful. And
yeah, but these are pretty quick. Like these slides too. So. Hello.
First two lectures, so I didn't give indication of when I was available for a tutorial.
How did we do for the two? Yeah, we haven't had a sign up. I think what we did last year, I think we just assigned them randomly and then fixed any.
Yes.
So with a class this size, we just started with a random initial assignment and then we fixed it to fix any conflicts.
Okay, so I don't need to.
So you don't need to do anything.
Hi. Just some, kind of a general question.
Yes.
Regarding the textbook.
Yes.
Are there sort of like recommendations of what chapters we should learn regarding connected to each lecture?
In terms of, yeah, I think they're kind of general recommendations of kind of the closest place in the textbook to each lecture.
Is that on the course website?
It should be, I think. So typically we've had them on the slides. So actually it's usually it'll say, I didn't go through the first slide here, but typically I think later on, yeah. Oh yeah, sorry. I think what we've done later on is actually say on the outline slide, it'll say what the recommended reading is.
Oh, and then just sort of follow according to that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, okay, cool. All right, fantastic. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi there. I see you've been using your Mac. Is it okay to you? I've got a guest speaker coming.
Yes.
They just plug in their.
Yeah, it's been fine as long as you have it on laptop.
He's got his own laptop.
Yeah, and it just kind of. It seems to just kind of work.
In fact, here it is, yeah.
Yeah.
This chat thing, it should work fine. Give it a go.
The reason why I got it.
Yeah.
So the reason is because the fluorescent ones show up really well.
Right.
Is it into this one?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
And it's on my laptop, so hopefully that will pick up. There's something like guest user access, but I think that's just for the PC.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, so we should come up with excuses.
Okay, switch on to this one. It's taking a while to. There's my note. I opened it too quickly, sorry. It's gone into a huff.
Alright.
Right, I'm going to crash it. Start again. silhouette to do when it gets into a huff.
I understand it's all pretty self-explanatory in terms of